From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. By the way, happy Thanksgiving to our Canadian neighbors. Yep, this is when they celebrate it. Later tonight, strange and unexplained hauntings. Here's what's happening. Samsung said it is halting sales of the star-crossed Galaxy Note 7 smartphone after a spate of fires involving new devices, now listen to this, that were supposed to be safe replacements for the recalled models. Separately, South Korean safety authorities said they found a new product defect in the Note 7 and urged consumers to stop using them. Folks, just stop, bring it back, get a refund, do whatever you have to do. There's something seriously wrong with this product. Airlines are beginning to tell people if they have one of these aboard the plane to definitely shut it off, even remove the battery if you can. A man in India has been electrocuted while listening to music on his charging cell phone. They said the 27-year-old suffered shocks, likely from an earphone attached to his mobile phone, which was plugged into an electrical outlet. His family in a small village rushed him to a clinic. He was pronounced dead. Wall Street rising amid gains across most sectors driven by oil prices, and the Democrat Hillary Clinton was widely seen as the winner of the second presidential debate. I'm not sure. A Clinton presidency would be more positive, they say, for the markets because her positions are more well-known than those of her Republican rival Donald Trump. That, according to a Reuters poll. And House Speaker Paul Ryan told fellow Republicans that he will no longer defend GOP nominee Donald Trump and will instead use the next 29 days to focus on preserving his party's hold on Congress. Dr. John Curtis first from onlinecolumnist.com. You have the floor, Mr. Curtis. What did you think about yesterday?
Well, I think it was a do or die situation for Trump, and I think he stepped up. I'm not sure that it changes any of Hillary's supporters' minds or any of his own base's minds. I mean, I think right now it's a race for those independents and those undecided voters. I think, you know, George, the Trump campaign with this revelation that came out on Friday about this videotape with Billy Bush and Access Hollywood was really hyped by the media as, you know, some kind of unpardonable act on his part. I think his Trump's campaign manager, Kelly Conway, came out and essentially said there's far more sordid behavior that goes on in the Beltway than anything Donald Trump has ever done, reminding people that, you know, some of the issues, and especially, and this to me is the most significant thing about this election, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, I think the war and peace issue has to be regarded as, because all else is lost, George, if this country gets into a nuclear exchange with Russia. We are now, and I've been talking about this for quite some time, in the most dangerous place we've been since the Cuban Missile Crisis in terms of a potential confrontation, a military confrontation with Russia. You heard Mike Pence in a debate about a week ago say that in order to protect terrorists and civilians that are connected with Aleppo, he's willing to use U.S. assets to attack the Syrian or the Russian military over there. Now, I don't know about you, but all of the Russia bashing that's been going on by Clinton for months now, and the implication that Trump somehow is working for the Russian government or has sympathies for fascist-like dictators, is missing the point. We've had 60 years of diplomacy to attempt to have a civil relationship with a nuclear power, once known as the Soviet Union, now known as the Russian Federation. This is the more significant issue than whether Trump uttered something in some secret recording at some point, not, you know, whether this country survives in the future. If there is a consensus within the Republican Party that's really expressed by John McCain, who is, you know, the head of the Senate Senate Armed Services Committee, that we should be involved in a confrontation with Russia in Syria. And I think that should be what people are thinking about right now. Who is more likely or less likely to get us into World War III?
And that's a very distinct possibility. I'll have more on that because Mikhail Gorbachev, the former Soviet leader, had some comments about that. I'll be talking about that in a second. Howard Bloom, of course, author of The Genius of the Beast. Howard, you have the final word.
Well, John's point about avoiding nuclear war is right on target. John McCain, who he cites, has bailed out totally on Donald Trump. The fact is, this was the most explosive weekend in this entire presidential campaign, and it may well be one of the most explosive weekends in American presidential campaign history. Donald Trump suffered a bashing that could have been fatal to his campaign thanks to the tape that John was talking about, and the debate seemed to keep him in the race. But even that act of survival could now be in question. A few hours ago, Politico reported that Donald Trump held an average of a 5-point lead at the end of last week before the sexual tape emerged. But now, according to an NBC Wall Street Journal poll, Donald Trump trails by an unbelievable 14 points. Yes, 14 points. Now, Politico adds that no candidate in the modern era of polling has ever climbed back from more than 4 points behind over the final month of the campaign to win the presidency. So what happened? Well, the tape came out, and panic hit the Republican Party. 34 Republicans on Saturday, 34 Republican elected officials deserted Donald Trump.
Yep.
Republican Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois called Trump, quote, a malignant clown, close quote. Republican Congressman Charlie Dent of Pennsylvania said the race was effectively over for Donald Trump. And the New York Times and Washington Post, of course, said that Trump's campaign is over, but they're against Donald Trump. So that really doesn't count. But they also reported panic in Trump Tower. Now, most major Republicans today held an emergency conference call. And that was the call at which Paul Ryan said he will no longer campaign with Trump or for Trump. And there's now turmoil in the Republican Party. There is talk about, as John said, saving the Republican majorities in Congress. But as John said, but he didn't quite give the implication, Kellyanne Conway did say that those Republicans who have abandoned Trump are hypocrites. Why? Because, she says, there is sexual dirt on them. And if that comes out, God knows.
And Howard, though, what, you know, a high 40% of the American people want Donald Trump in there. That's a pretty high percent.
It's a high percent, and it's a strongly divided country. We've seen these kinds of divisions before between Republicans and Democrats, but nonetheless, the gulf between Democrats and Republicans about how they see the world. Each is in its own little fantasy world. Each works with something called confirmation bias. In other words, it takes in facts that support its already entrenched point of view, and it rules out facts that don't support that point of view. So there are 40% of the people of America are basically convinced that Hillary Clinton is a criminal, that she is a liar, and that she will destroy America. And the 40% who are against Donald Trump are convinced that Donald Trump is a criminal, a villain, a liar, and will destroy America. We're going to have to put this country back together.
We sure are. We're going to have to patch it back together. And as I was mentioning about the former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, well, he has warned that the world has reached a dangerous point as tensions between Russia and the United States spike over the Syrian conflict. Dr. Jerome Corsi, who writes for WND.com, is with us. Jerry, Gorbachev is right. It's getting dangerous.
It is getting dangerous, George. And I think the inability of the Obama administration to really reach any kind of accord right now with Russia is very concerning. Clearly, Russia is ramping up the military action with Assad to take control in Syria. This Aleppo right now is the major target of the Soviet air attacks. And, you know, you get a situation where Russia is looking to the United States increasingly as an adversary. And I don't see that changing in the immediate future. Hillary Clinton's attempt to put all of the blame on Russia for the hacking is not proven, and it just intensifies the relationships deteriorating. I don't know what Donald Trump's position would be in the future with Russia. He has the potential of reaching out to Russia, but it's unproven yet.
Right.
I don't think I've seen in the last 50 years this much rhetoric from Russia about nuclear war, and it's very frightening that Russia is thinking that way and the tensions are escalating.
I hope these tensions go away. Jerry, thank you. We'll continue to talk with you. Dr. Corsi, John Curtis, Howard Bloom, and many others will be part of our November 8th election coverage for the live five-hour presentation. Rescue crews were reaching and racing to reach as many as 1,500 people stranded at their homes in North Carolina after a levee broke Monday, one day after Hurricane Matthew unleashed treacherous flooding and moved out to sea now. The storm killed at least 21 people in the U.S., 10 in North Carolina, hundreds in Haiti as well. In a moment, we're going to be talking about the penny jumper. That's right. What is it? Stick around and find out next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Yes, I was only about a mile away from the debates last night, and post-debates, everybody showed up at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, and I had a chance to meet a lot of folks from CNN. They were out there, and also House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi was out there. Interesting night, indeed. And, of course, one more debate coming up soon in Las Vegas, and then elections, and we shall see what happens. Anyway, we've got a fascinating night for you tonight. Our first guest is James Grippendo. He is a counsel at one of the nation's leading law firms where he specializes in entertainment and intellectual property law, represents clients who have won more than 30 Tony Awards. His law firm represented Goldman Sachs in connection with the federal government's high-profile prosecution of a former computer programmer who was accused of stealing confidential source codes for the company's high-speed trading system. We'll talk a little bit about that, but here's James on the show, The Penny Jumper, one of his books. Hey, James, welcome.
Good morning.
Looking forward to this. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Good. Goldman Sachs, how are they doing these days?
Well, they certainly were in the hot topic of discussion, at least when Bernie Sanders was in the race. And this is The Penny Jumper was a book that I wrote that really came out of something that started way back in 2009 when one of its programmers in the world of high-frequency trading was indicted by the federal government. Now, you don't hear about that often, about people being indicted on Wall Street, and this one was in a more esoteric sense, because it delved into an area that few people really even understand. You know, you hear the broad allegations that Wall Street is rigged and the stock market is rigged and so forth, but very few people understand that 70% of the trades that are made on Wall Street aren't even made by human beings. They are made by computers, and one of the computer algorithms, which we can talk more about, that controls those trades is an algorithm called the Penny Jumper, and that was the name of the book.
Now, what is an algorithm?
Well, you know, if you put physicists and computer scientists and so forth, mathematicians in a room, and you probably wouldn't get an agreement of a formal definition. but for someone like me, who was doing the research for the book and trying to understand how algorithms affect our everyday life, it's simple way to think of it is just as a set of rules that lays out a sequence of steps that's needed for a machine or computer to perform certain tasks. And, you know, we think of them in terms of computers, because computers have certainly increased our awareness of how they affect our lives, but they existed long before computers. And so what makes algorithms interesting is when they tell these computers to do very human-like functions. When I got into the research for the book, I discovered that, yeah, this really came to the forefront with high-frequency trading, but algorithms have, there's it may be a little hyperbole to say it, but And they have really taking over the world in a lot of ways. And some of those are frightening, and some of them are, hey, that's cool.
Talk show host Charlie Rose was interviewing a robot, James. You know, and I looked at this and I'm going, oh my God, what is happening? But this entire field is moving so fast. Is it, in your opinion, out of control?
Well, I think it's certainly not understood. You know, there are things that are obvious to us that we kind of get it when an algorithm is at work, right? You know, when we use our gadgets, we understand, and you know, and we're maybe shopping, and you know, and you go online, and somehow there's this magical recommendation of a product that you actually like, you know, but you know, we all get it that there's not some poor guy trapped in a room reviewing our purchase history and making these recommendations to us, right? You understand that there is an algorithm telling a computer the data is input based upon your purchasing history and based upon other personal data about you which is the scary part, which that companies have collected on you that indicate your buying preferences. So we understand that. But there's other places where we come into contact with algorithms where we'd be pretty surprised to find out. I mean, one that I think I find that people find most shocking, for example, is, you know, when you get on, you dial in a customer service, and we've all heard that refrain, you know, this call may be monitored for training purposes.
Or recorded, yeah.
Or recorded, right? Okay. Well, and that may be in some instances that it's simply some supervisor is going to listen in. But in many instances, what we're doing is we are allowing about 6 million algorithms to be unleashed, to listen to our tone of voice, to listen to our sentence structure, to analyze how we use pronouns, verbs, and construct our sentences, and assigns us a personality quotient. Now, how is that used? Well, it's almost like a form of robotic psychoanalysis based on this call. And there is a company that has stored millions and millions and millions of these phone calls in a data bank about the size of a football field in Minnesota. And this data is drawn upon to assign every caller a personality quotient. And so that, and the good part of this is that, so that the next time you call in, your phone number, of course, is attached to that quotient, so they know who you are and what personality you have, and your call will then be routed to a customer service representative who has a similar personality. And according to the company, anyway, that increases the satisfaction rating from about 47% to 90%, and the calls are half as long. So we have algorithms doing sort of, at least maybe not psychoanalysis, but certainly pop psychology on us based upon how we talk and what we say, and so that when we dial in and our phone number appears in their system, they probably know why we're calling and in some ways what we're thinking.
I had to call a credit card company a couple days ago just to check on a charge, and I didn't even talk to a human being, James. I mean, they identified me with my phone call, and all I had to do was type in the last four numbers of my card number. They knew exactly who I was. They say, we've matched you with your phone. And then they answered any question I had by push button.
Right.
It was amazing.
And a lot of how we've gotten here has come about through the use and development of algorithms in the financial world, you know, and that was, we learned basically what both my research for the book and experience as an attorney is that Wall Street didn't do a very good job of distinguishing between the useful and helpful components of algorithms and the menacing and disturbing aspects of algorithms gone haywire or gone out of control. And the best example of that is that, you know, is to point to it's called the flash crash.
Let's come back and talk about that, and talk about the upside and downside of all of this. James Rapondo, our special guest, next on Coast to Coast AM. Great song, so I'm in a mellow mood tonight. Hey, our special guest tonight, James Rapondo, as we talk about his work, The Penny Jumper, as we get into really the high tech of what's going on, whether it's good or bad. We'll chat with him about that when we come back in a moment. Okay, welcome back to this high-tech portion of Coast to Coast. James Rapondo with us. His book, one of them, is called The Penny Jumper. The other was Gone Again. James, you were talking about something called the flash. What was that?
The flash crash in 2010 was when suddenly, in the span of 5 minutes, 9% or $1 trillion worth of wealth sort of vanished on the stock market.
Poof, gone.
Yeah, and to this day, no one really can unravel what happened in that instant. But the best explanation is simply that it was sort of algorithms chasing algorithms in the world of high-speed trading that led to this phenomenon, which makes you wonder how many people really understand what's going on. And when 70% of the trades by volume on Wall Street, on the various exchanges around the world, not just Wall Street, but all around the world, the exchanges all over the world, from Hong Kong to London to New York and so forth, 70% of the trades are being conducted by computers through algorithms mm-hmm. like the penny jumper that I mentioned in the book. So, you know, here's one way. The penny jumper is just one of many type of algorithms that are out there sort of controlling Wall Street. The way the easiest way to understand it, here's an example to make, and you can decide for yourself whether you think this is really of any value to society, is, you know, I took my son to his first Chicago Cubs game.
And I bet he loved it.
He did love it, you know, but it's not easy to get a seat. So you gotta,
especially right about now.
Right, you gotta pay a scalper, right? So let's say, you know, we have a budget of $100 per ticket that we're gonna pay for to get into the game, right? So we go and we find a scalper, and he's only got one ticket for us. So it's like, well, I'm willing to pay $100. I tell the scalper, but we need another seat.
And you kind of want to sit close together, right?
Yeah. Well, let's put that out of the equation.
All right.
But, okay. So, we need another ticket that we want to. I mean, we're willing to pay $100 for that ticket. So some guy standing next to us hears us say we're willing to pay $100 for another ticket. He runs off down the street to the corner, finds the next scalper, buys a ticket for $100, and sells it to us when we approach. For $100.01. And we're like, okay, you know, the extra penny isn't going to kill us, right? Our budget was $100.
Exactly.
So we'll go ahead and pay the $100.01. Now, that guy made that money only because he heard us say that we were willing to pay $100 for a second ticket. That's sort of what penny jumping is about on Wall Street.
And they add up, don't they?
And they add up because these trades are being made in microseconds, millions of trades in microseconds. And I'll give you an idea how fast a microsecond is. It takes 500,000 microseconds for you to click a mouse.
Wow.
On a computer. Okay, 500,000 microseconds. If my algorithm, my penny jumper, or towing the whale, or all of these other names that they've put onto these algorithms that dictate trading on Wall Street, if my algorithm is 5 microseconds slower than the next guy, I'm ancient history. I'm a dead bang.
You're out.
Loser. I'm a dead bang loser, yes. So when you think of this, you know, the penny jumping, you know, 1 cent on information that has leaked out into the marketplace through algorithms that pick up patterns in trading, right? That's what this is. They're not literally standing over our shoulder listening to us conduct a transaction like I described outside of Wrigley Field. What the algorithms are doing is picking up patterns in cyberspace, in trading, and recognizing that, you know, what's happening here is, wow, there's a transaction for the sale of 50,000 shares of General Electric. And over here on this exchange is a sale of another 25,000 shares of General Electric. And then suddenly the algorithm realizes, holy cow, somebody is selling off a massive, massive block of General Electric stock. And the algorithm will react to that perceived pattern that is put together like a puzzle and figured out, I'm going to go buy GE. And it goes across the various markets, wherever it can be. It might be the NASDAQ. It might be the New York Stock Exchange. It might be the BATS Exchange, and starts buying up that stock and selling it to the other algorithm at a penny profit, millions and millions and millions of time. So, again, that's sort of, it's sort of like, it makes you think, well, how is that adding anything?
It adds up.
Well, it makes money, but from the social utility standpoint, it makes
no
wonder of what value are we adding to.
Well, James, when we get the next bubble burst, and we will, because it goes in slight cycles, so it'll happen. Yeah. What happens to the market electronically? Does it shut down? What will they do when the next one starts?
Well, I think the answer is, you know, we don't know, because unless trading is shut down by and the market closes, we don't really know how these algorithms are going to react, because and that's sort of where the science of this thing gets a little complicated, because an algorithm is supposed to be something that has a beginning and an end. But when you inject certain levels of computer programming into it, some of these algorithms will chase after themselves infinitely. And that's where why it became so difficult for anyone to unravel what happened in a situation like the flash crash of 2010, which sounds like ancient history now. That's almost 6 years ago, and still no one's figured out how $9 trillion sort of evaporated in 5 minutes.
That's amazing. Now, you have mentioned that there are more than 2,000 physicists working on Wall Street. What the heck are they doing?
Yeah, that was sort of the very first thing when I started doing research for the book, is when I came across that number. I had to look at it again when I thought, how do they get there? Why are they there? And what are they doing? And it turns out that physicists who are able to write these complex algorithms are in very high demand by the Wall Street firms. They have different names for them. Some of them sound kind of derogatory, quants or props or what have you. But these are people who understand, well, one thing they understand very fundamentally is, and it's fundamental to physics, is the concept of time. And I described how quickly these things are, these trades are occurring, so that time synchronization is a very key component of the high-frequency trading world. And when I'm talking about time synchronization, it's not like two guys, checking their watches and make sure that they're at the same time.
Right.
We're talking in atomic clocks concept of time here, so that
no mistakes.
There is absolutely, yes. I think. And even the atomic clocks are coming along to the point now where the latest atomic clock that was created in 2016 in Germany is 100 times more accurate than the one that was that creators just announced in 2014 was supposed to be 100 times greater than the one before that. So we may be reaching a point of we can't measure time in any thinner slices than we are measuring them right now. But that was really where physicists had an edge that made them very valuable employees on Wall Street, was the algorithms that they could write that could coordinate trades happening around the world without this any interval of time. Now, that's led to some pretty bizarre results, too, outside the idea of a physicist working on Wall Street. For example, this concept of how close are you, how close are your computer servers to the trading centers became an issue. And there's in Washington, in New York City, there is the old Western Union building is on Hudson Street, where they used to literally used to send the telegraphs from. The building's pretty much empty now. when I say empty, I mean empty of human beings.
Yeah.
It is filled now with computers, servers, wires,
jeez,
because it just so happens that that building is located where the fiber optic cables that come up through the ground to wire Manhattan.
That's got to be heavily protected, I bet.
Is right there. That's exactly right. So everyone, when you're talking in a world where 5 microseconds is the difference between the winners and the losers, everyone wants their servers right at what it became known as the quote unquote the carrier hotel, because there was nothing in there except the equipment that was needed to carry the electronic current that affected these trades from 60 Hudson Street in New York City.
James, a few weeks ago, computer systems went down for Southwest Airlines, and it created just a mess for people. I mean, plane flights got canceled. Things were slow. It was a disaster. I mean, and that's just one little facet of all of this. When the major ones happen and there are outages, what's going to happen to society?
Yeah, you know, that's really, we don't realize how dependent we are, right, on all of these systems until you have a major glitch like that. Now, and that's the scary part of it. Now, the other side of it is, there are things that are making our life a lot easier. You know, for example, I mean, you know, there's a commercial on TV that I laugh at now because I think it's Tarzan and Jane arguing about directions or something like that. Why don't you just ask for directions? Which plays on the old concept of men never ask for directions. Well, you know what? My kids never ask for directions, and they've never had an argument in their life about directions, because directions are given to us by an algorithm now, right? We just plug in our and rely on GPS to get directions. Now, the downside of that is my kids probably couldn't even tell you the names of the streets that are two blocks away, because they've never had to describe to anyone how to get from A to B. You know, they just get in and their noses are in their phones and there you have it. So, it is definitely a trade-off, but in the world of high finance, the trade-off is, yes, it's definitely more efficient, right? You know, you can find, you know, the goal is always is the same. You know, you want to find match a willing buyer with a willing seller, and hopefully the seller makes a little profit and the market is functioning well. Well, you know, algorithms, you know, when they're working well, make that happen at the speed of light, you know, literally.
Yes.
But when you have a situation like the flash crash, where the system is so opaque to a human being that no one can, push a button or tweak this and tweak that and keep the market from losing $9 trillion in five minutes, then it makes you realize we need a better understanding.
Do they realize that things are going wrong? If, for example, when they lost the trillions of dollars, did they realize, oh, my gosh, something's happening?
Yeah. I mean, it was panic, you know, really, literally panic within the markets. And, you know, who knows what would happen if 5 minutes had turned into 15 minutes or 15 minutes into 50 minutes and so forth. It could have been a financial meltdown, no doubt about it. So, one good thing about that, like I say, is that I think that the world of high finance provides a bit of a warning to us all, out as algorithms filter into our lives. From, as I described earlier, just, you know, the customer service call, and they're psychoanalyzing our voice, tone of voice, and our sentence structure and so forth. you know, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Hopefully people will be asking that question before they put the algorithms at play. You know, right now, I think here's another example of where this could go on the market, right? Is algorithms can read, you know, in a sense, they can read, right?
So they're almost like human beings with faster brains.
Yeah. So, you know, and it takes about, I guess, about 4 seconds for the average human being to read a tweet or read a headline in a newspaper. Well, an algorithm can read it a lot faster than we can. And so, you know, let's say there's a major crisis affecting oil production in the Mideast. Well, the algorithm can read that faster than we can. And before we've even finished reading our tweet, the algorithm will have sold off oil futures.
What?
Yeah, so now...
Well, does the algorithm anticipate?
Well, that's a good question. And that would be the next step, right? It would not only be anticipate, but what scares me more than that is if it can read the news...
And project.
Can it also put out the news?
Yeah.
Right? And so then we've got algorithms now reading the news, but what happens when algorithms start tweeting? And we have misinformation out there. And
or James, let me ask you this. I mean, with this screwed up election the way it is, could an algorithm read the signs and say, well, I don't like Trump or I don't like Hillary Clinton. This is who I'm going to pick, and this is going to be the winner. In every computer that they're connected to changes things.
Yeah, you know, that you'd have to get one of those 2,000 physicists who works on Wall Street probably to answer that.
Somebody might already have gotten to them.
Yeah. But your point is well taken. You know, that is the future. And it's so, you know, it's not really a question of will algorithms you know, take over human function. It's really about which ones we understand that they are taking over, which ones they will allow to take over, and which ones maybe they'll just decide for themselves to take over.
Wow, that is scary stuff. All right, stick with us, James. We're going to come back in a moment. Next hour, we're going to take phone calls. So questions, or those of you who are really into this tech stuff, jump on board with us. James Gripando with us. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Also, his links to Facebook and Twitter. Yep, he's social. And then his book is called The Penny Jumper. We're just talking about algorithms, something that you normally don't think about every day. But let me tell you something. People who are in the high tech know exactly what's going on with these things and how they will affect all of us. So we'll be back in a moment on coasttocoastam.com. And also don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter as well.